What is our fascination with the red planet, Mars? In a moment, we'll talk with Sir Charles Schulz III about Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Regular guest here at Coast to Coast, Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems, computer-based automated test equipment as well. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system, worked on the Patriot, the Copperhead tank killer, and the advanced attack helicopter systems. Charles has performed research under grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Sir Charles, my friend, how are you?
I'm doing very well, George. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. You bring us interesting things to think about, Sir Charles. You really do. What have you been doing lately?
Well, a lot of my research in the last couple of years has been in green energy and solar power and purification of water. And, of course, everybody has to make a little bread and butter. But, of course, the interest in Mars never waned, and I've finished my book on the subject, The Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars, and I'll go over some of that information as well.
Perfect. When you started looking at some of the anomalies on Mars, what did you look at it with just the computer, and then you blew it up? What gave you the perspective that you had?
Well, a lot of it comes from studying Mars for many years in the past. I think that everybody who knows anything about the solar system has a great interest in the planets, their geology and atmospheres, and how they're the same as our world and how different they are. And so a lot of the background information came from years of previous study. When the information came back, everything that you could download from the Internet was fair game. And, of course, using the computer allows you to download the information and study it in depth. And, of course, there are limits to the resolution of the images, so it's good to have many images and many sources of information to deal with.
There's been a picture floating around the Internet over the last couple weeks about Mars. It looks like a log or a piece of wood. Have you seen that one?
Yes, I have. In fact, that comes from very early on in the mission, around Sol 110 to 120, Opportunity in the area of Endurance Crater. And in fact, it isn't a log at all. It's the edge of one of those sedimentary slabs. As anybody that looks at the images for any period of time knows, those are all sedimentary rock laid down underwater.
Okay. What do we find so fascinating with Mars? I mean, I even know, Charles, that when I was a youngster, I mean, I was just obsessed with that planet, more so Venus than more so Saturn, even though Saturn looked great through a telescope. It was Mars that captured my imagination. How come?
Well, it's because Mars is so very much like the Earth. When we look around our solar system, most of the planets are either very, very cold, have thick atmospheres, crushing atmospheres, or they're very hot. And Mars is right in that moderate zone where it's quite likely, as people look at it, they realize that it could support something that's alive. So it's a place that you can go, and it's a place that you can see, a place that you literally can touch with your mind right now, and very shortly, hopefully, with human astronauts.
Yeah, eventually. I would hope sooner than later. I don't know how many years it's going to take. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm hearing these figures of 20 to 30 years, and I think that's terribly pessimistic. I believe that if we were to turn this over to the commercial sector, we could get this done in about 10 to 15.
I think you're right. And you know what concerns me, too, is that if we sit on our duff too long, I think another country will attempt to do this.
Well, they're certainly making moves on the moon right now, you know. India, China, and Russia have all expressed great interest in the moon, and both China and Russia are going to be mining it for helium-3 in the very near future.
Well, that's because they're getting smart about alternative energy sources, aren't they?
Absolutely, and there's plenty of energy out there free for the taking. We just need to get up and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have you been watching, by the way, what's been going on with the automobile industry in Congress?
Well, I have, and it's a little bit discouraging because there are so many other things we could be doing. And I must admit, gasoline is king. It's very hard to displace because you can put an awful lot of energy in a tank of gas. But there are alternatives, and they are being explored and expanded upon right now.
We've got to get you back for an energy show in the future.
We'd certainly be glad to.
Now, when I look at Mars, I look at what Earth could end up like. When I look at Earth, I look at what I think Mars used to be. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you absolutely, because over time, atmosphere and ocean get lost. You know, planets don't have infinite attraction, and the erosion from solar wind and loss from gravity means your air is going away, and your oceans are going away. And Mars, being a very small world, just doesn't have enough mass to hold on to its atmosphere and its air. But it also has another problem, and that is it doesn't have a lot of volcanic activity. And on Earth, that's what replaces our oceans and our atmospheres. So on Mars, those things aren't working very well, and they have a very small core, and their air has been lost. But there is another factor involved, and that is the oceans didn't completely vanish on Mars. They actually are still present, but in the form of glaciers in many areas, just under less than an inch of soil, just a centimeter or so of soil.
In terms of the equipment that we have on Mars, that have, I think they've been doing just a phenomenal job, Sir Charles, getting us some data and getting us great pictures. You got to congratulate the folks that have worked on that, huh?
Oh, no doubt. You know, it took a huge amount of effort to create hardware as durable and reliable as those rovers. They were originally specced to only last 90 days, and they've been pushing 5 years now.
You know, the similarities between Earth and Mars, if it would only have held its atmosphere, if it could have kept its water the way we have ours, you know, it probably could have fostered life. We'll get into that with you a little bit later on. And then later on tonight, Richard C. Hoagland will join us for a bit to chat with you, too. I want to just see the two titans of Mars chat about this thing, this incredible planet. But what do you think happened to Mars, assuming it had these oceans, it had an atmosphere, whether it had life or not, we'll get into that. But what do you think happened to the planet? Why did it all dissipate or sink into the ground?
Well, of course, the number one issue is it's a very small world, and it doesn't have a great deal of gravity. There's only about 38% as much gravitational pull on its surface, so it can't hold on to its atmosphere. It's constantly leaking off into space like an airbag with a puncture in it. And over the course of time, as the atmosphere gets thinner, the boiling point of water goes down, and it's harder to keep water in a liquid form. But one of the biggest contributors to its loss, other than its small size, is that Mars does not have a large moon as the Earth does. Now, if you've ever watched a top spin, it begins to wobble as it spins down. Well, planets wobble as well on their axis.
Sure.
And for our world, we have a moon, a very large, massive moon, that keeps our axis more or less stable. It dampens out those vibrations or oscillations. Mars, unfortunately, doesn't have a massive moon, and so as a result, its axis tumbles a lot, and its seasons can vary wildly in the space of 50,000 years.
Do you think that when Mars formed and then when it got its ocean-type waters, it then almost immediately started losing them at the same time?
Oh, absolutely right. In fact, both of the planets, Earth and Mars, apparently had around 250 to 300 atmospheres of pressure when they were first formed and molten. So you can imagine how much air had to have been lost over the many billions of years in order for it to reach the present-day state that we see it in.
Is that happening to us now, too?
Well, yes, it is. It has been all along. In fact, if you look at the fossil record on Earth, you'll see many gigantic creatures such as two-foot cockroaches and dragonflies and giant insects. And people wonder how in the world such things could possibly have existed. Well, the answer is very simple. We had nearly twice as much atmosphere back during the Permian era on our planet, and that air has been lost over the last 360, 400 million years.
You're still looking for new discoveries. Tell me how and why.
Well, all the time. You never stop looking once you've made a discovery. The most prominent method of doing the research is to download all the new images and continue to go over them. And if you can find three or four shots of the same place from a different angle or from different imagers, you can get much better resolution than a single monochrome image, the little black and white pictures you see. And the reason why is very simple. Once you recognize something like this, you know you're onto something of major importance, and it's something that people need to know about. It expresses a lot about our past, not just the past of Mars, but it also tells us one other thing. When we look around the universe in times to come and we begin exploring planets around other stars, we're going to find a lot of them are probably a lot more like Mars than like Earth. And so Mars gives us the key to understanding, perhaps, many of the worlds we're going to find in other solar systems in the future.
Now, of course, this recent discovery that there are glaciers on Mars, what's the significance of that?
Well, there are two significant factors, and one is they knew this many years ago, actually. But one of the most significant things is, with the addition of a little bit of heat, that water could return. But imagine this as well. Since we know that those glaciers are there, they had to be formed with huge ocean-sized bodies of water. So that's one of the very strong indicators that that water was in a liquid form not long ago. And if you look at the cratering, the amount of craters on a given area or surface of the planet,
right,
you can tell, you can date it, just like an archaeologist would date something. You can tell how long that water has been there. Well, the glacier field on the equator of Mars is less than 5 million years old. And that means that 5 million years ago, not 5 billion years ago, or 3 billion, which is the typical figure quoted by NASA, 5 million years ago or less, there had to be an ocean on the planet. And that's, you know, just a drop in the bucket as far as this, the flow of time goes.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's nothing in the scheme of things. And then, what created that dissipation then? You just think the loss of the atmosphere caused the water to evaporate?
Well, actually, it didn't all evaporate, of course, as you know, that it's there in the form of glaciers. But what
right.
has happened is the planet is in an ice age, and it's been a long-term ice. There's very little on Mars to keep its temperature up as we have on Earth. Now, Mars is a very dark planet. It absorbs about 85% of the sunlight falling on it. The Earth only absorbs about 62, 63% of the sunlight falling on it. We reflect a lot of heat back to space. But its changing climate over time and its loss of atmosphere has made it tougher to stay warm. And the only thing keeping the planet very warm now is that the greenhouse effect from its mostly carbon dioxide atmosphere is heating the planet about 20 degrees C warmer than it would otherwise be.
Take me through the stages of a glacier forming.
Well, in essence, the ocean, as the temperatures drop and icebergs form, they will eventually start covering the surface of that ocean, and it will drive out all the salt lower and lower in level. And eventually, as the ocean freezes solid and all of its organisms, if any, are present, and all of its salts and minerals are forced to the bottom layers of the ice, eventually you end up with a smooth, flat surface. And over time, the wind sculpts and erodes it down until it's just about as flat as it can be. Now, on Mars, there's a lot of orange rust-colored dust, and that dust and soil gets blown around the planet during the dust storms. Eventually, that dust covers those glaciers, and you end up with huge fractured areas that have these cracks in them that are very characteristic and easy to recognize. So over the course of a couple of million years, you can freeze an ocean very easily, and you end up with these glacier fields. They get covered with dust, and then the meteors hit them, and we have an indicator of their age.
How tall do you think these glaciers could be?
Well, some of them are actually estimated to be as much as a half a mile or more in thickness. There are some deposits of ice that we see in some craters that represent enough water to give everyone on Earth plenty. We would never run out on Mars if we were to go and just start warming up the soil and the glaciers that we find. But there's enough water, if you were to melt just the polar caps, to cover the planet in something like 15 to 30 meters, depending on whose estimates you listen to. So you could literally bring the planet's oceans back by warming it up right now.
One of the things that you and Richard have in common, you look for fossils. You know, he has, through his enterprisemission.com, for years been looking for fossils on Mars. You do too. That tells me both of you are convinced that there was some kind of life on Mars.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind for a number of reasons, but the finding of these fossils and the odd artifacts in the picture that I submitted, for instance, and that I have on my website,
yes,
are very key pieces of evidence. And many of these things are difficult for people to see, but many of them are also very obvious.
Do you think NASA knows if they're
no
that
doubt
obvious?
In my mind, there's no doubt at all. In fact, the issue has been brought to their attention, and they've visited my website many times. And the issue is very strange because many people in the past have recorded, they resort to something known as the Brookings Report to explain
yes.
why NASA won't talk about alien life. And, of course, the Brookings Report is not very recent. It's been around for many ages. It basically was an assessment of society, and the basic statement was, if we were to release information that alien life existed, it could cause religious repercussions that would, you know, cause a great deal of problems in the world. The recent version of the Brookings Report is called the NASA Societal Report, and in this they confront the same issue, and they come to the conclusion that they need to have a plan in place to handle the societal reaction to an announcement of the existence of alien life. But then they gloss over it quite a bit. And now realize in the Brookings Report, nobody recommended one way or the other what should be done. They didn't say the government should hide it. They simply said, we recommend basically that you be aware of the reactions that could exist.
Right.
In the
right.
societal report, which was just produced in 1999, they actually went so far as saying we need to put a plan in place and not really push this information until we know how to handle it and how people are going to handle it. Personally, I don't feel there's going to be any real repercussion because most people are reasonable enough to know that facts are what counts, not belief.
But what are we talking about, though, Charles? Because I thought when the Brookings came out in 60 that talked about, alien life, I think their assumption was ET-type life. I mean, little grays or something like that. And that's what I think they felt people could not handle. Do you think that's what they had in mind, or are we talking about little microbes?
Well, in a word, they were thinking about big walking around, talking technological aliens back in
yes.
the Brookings report. That was the, yes. that was the implied finding. And nobody really discussed whether or not finding microbes or worms or seashells would be anything of a big issue. However, when we really get down to the issue, any living organism that's not on the Earth is an alien organism if it's not sharing our genetic code or our origins. And people aren't going to be so upset about it. But the long-term implications are what is important. Because if we find that a rather inhospitable place such as Mars had a rich biosphere with all these fossils left afterwards, then what can we say about other worlds? People don't survive a meeting very easily with a more technically advanced civilization. And by definition, since we don't have the ability to go to the stars just now, if we meet intelligent aliens, they might have the ability to get here from a very great distance, and that implies a high technological level of development.
I think so, too. And you see, I think people have been so desensitized now. Programs like this, Charles, movies, exposure everywhere. I think most people expect ET life to exist.
Well, absolutely. I think I have to agree with you on that, because half of every movie we see, half of every fiction we hear, is based on the assumption that there's somebody out there.
Tell me about the fossils that you believe existed on Mars.
Well, basically, they're marine remains. And when you think about it, simple organisms live in our oceans that are pretty universal, such as sea urchins and clams and very, very simple things. And if you have an ocean on any planet, you would expect similar forms to evolve. And the discovery I made was actually quite by accident, but I find that earlier researchers also found what appeared to be evidence of marine fossils in the past. Now, what I have found is basically the remains of organisms that look like sea urchins. We found some shark's teeth. We find seashells. But everything, again, is of a marine nature. And on Mars, the air was very thin. The oceans would function as a surrogate atmosphere so that anything in the ocean could get dissolved gases and would have enough protection from the ultraviolet and the environment around them. So it's just basically marine fossils, nothing exciting to most people who are looking for aliens.
Do you think Mars at one time, though, was a lush planet? It had trees and shrubs and grass and everything like that?
Well, any biosystem has to have the ability to gather basic energy. So you have to have plants, you have to have diatoms, you have to have bacteria. These forms would be present in any biosphere if you're supporting animal organisms. And by all accounts that I can see, they were supporting animal life. As to how lush the planet is, that's debatable. We really don't have enough information at this point because we haven't explored a lot of the areas in great detail. And imagine what a planet looks like when you remove its most of its atmosphere and all of its surface water for any significant period of time, such as 5 or 10 million years. It's going to destroy a lot of signs that would have been left behind otherwise. Just imagine the Earth being done in that manner and imagine what you'd find on the surface. Not much.
The deserts in Africa, the deserts in the Middle East, they were lush at one time, and they look Mars-like now.
Well, absolutely right, and that's one of the points. If you remove surface water, though, even though the surface becomes very much like a desert, you still have artesian springs, you have glaciers, you have wells from underground, and you have a water table. And those things don't go away very easily, and they're still present on Mars as well, in my estimation.
All right, well, stay with us, Sir Charles Schultz. His website, xenotechresearch.com, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz, will be joined later by Richard C. Hoagland, and Sir Charles then will be with us for phone calls in the final hour. Have you subscribed yet to the After Dark magazine? Well, if not, do so, or when you renew, you'll get two CDs, Art Bell Interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin, when you call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coast2coastam.com. And back with Sir Charles Schulz. Sir Charles, do you think there's anything alive on the planet today?
Well, I don't doubt that at the very least there will be bacterial and fungal organisms still alive, and I think that that was indicated by the Viking results back in 1976 when they did the labeled release experiment. They found what clearly looked like biology in the soil at that time.
Well, but anything more significant, do you think? I mean, little worms in the ground or anything?
Well, it's very much possible. Imagine every time we look at the most extreme environments on our planet, we seem to find unknown organisms by the dozens. So in my estimation, yes, there's got to be more than just bacteria. And also consider that many things on our Earth, such as brine shrimp or water bears or other organisms, can go into hibernation literally for a century or more. And then with the addition of water, they come right back to life as if nothing happened. So I would not be very surprised to discover that there were many things living on the surface. And with the addition of a little water and heat, they would come back.
Brine shrimp, I think that's what we had as kids. You'd buy these little packs, right? And you'd
exactly,
dump them in the water,
yeah.
And they'd come alive.
You drop a little dust-looking material. It's really their eggs and some water. And within a couple of hours, you've got brine shrimp swimming around. So imagine if the organisms on Mars had the same sort of adaptation. They could be in hibernation for centuries. And then as soon as a little water comes back, it wouldn't take but one out of a million of them to survive a couple of centuries of hibernation, and the species would be back in action again.
You know, I have always thought that the primordial soup is the same all throughout the universe, Sir Charles. You know, it's just a matter of conditions on a planet. You know, is it warm enough? Does it have enough water? But I think the soup is the same. It's everywhere. So Mars has got to have, or at least had, some kind of life. And I think other planets probably do too. You know, Europa might have had it. Maybe still does.
Well, that's a good point. You know, the same chemicals exist all throughout the universe, and the laws of chemistry and physics are universal. So anywhere that you've got a little ultraviolet light or a little lightning, and you have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and those are everywhere, you're going to find the primordial soup. It forms automatically. And the material actually has a name. It's called tholin, T-H-O-L-I-N. And it's very easy to produce. And in fact, I've got to mention the book on how to make your own tholin if you'd like to try it out.
Please, go ahead.
Well, basically, all you need is a source of water, some ammonia, some carbon of some sort, such as methane, and a lightning discharge, or a neon transformer, for instance. And I go through the steps on how to do it. Very simple. You seal up a container, you put the materials in, and you run the electric current. And when this was done originally, it was called the Uri Miller experiment. And what they found was it generated amino acids, it generated sugars, alcohols, and a lot of other biological materials from non-biological or abiotic materials. And anybody can do it, really. It's very simple.
What about other anomalies that might be on the planet?
Well, I've got a page I sent to you that has a picture, and it shows a number of objects that certainly are more than rocks. One of the things that stands out to people is geometric shapes, and we've got one object that is a perfect pentagon with a hole in the center, and it's hollow. That's a little hard to explain from a rock standpoint. Another one looks like a curled object, very hard to describe unless you see the image. But there are many objects shaped like a rind. Imagine taking a seed pod and pulling the rind off of it,
right,
or cutting an avocado in sections and pulling the seed out of the middle. Well, these things are all over the planet, and I found a couple of dozen of them after going through the images. And it appears that what these are the segments of something known as a blastoid. We had an organism that lived in our seas many years ago. They're now extinct, but they're related to sea lilies or crinoids. And these organisms left their remains apparently all over the planet. And I've got a number of those pictured, some in color, some in stereo, on the site, and even in animation on YouTube that some people can find. But it doesn't surprise me that these things have been passed up by the rovers, because the imaging teams, when testing the hardware, drove the rovers through the petrified forest and were unable to recognize petrified wood with it. Not only that, the Viking teams, when they were testing their imagers, had an incident where a fellow placed a trilobite fossil in the field. And when the imager ran over the trilobite fossil and produced the picture, people talked themselves out of believing what they saw. And when they did a news press conference, because they even practiced those when they were getting ready for the mission, somebody jokingly said, well, it looks like we found life on Mars, and they became very upset about that. So there appears to be an internal bias against finding life within NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, and it's very odd because these are the people we're counting on to make these discoveries for us, and it appears they failed miserably.
Well, how long do you think some of these anomalies have been on the planet?
It could be 10 years, could be 10,000 years. It's very hard to say because in the course of events, fossils will erode out of a rock, drop to the surface perhaps, and lay there on the surface until somebody comes along and finds it. And in some cases, if you just turn the dirt over with a shovel, you can find things very easily as well. And we really don't have that option with the existing rovers because they don't have shovels or grabbers or manipulators of any sort. So it's only by the greatest chance if you run over a slab of rock and it tips and it brings something up to the surface that you'll spot some of these items. But many of them are in beautiful shape. Some of them have wonderful patterns on them that are easy to see.
What about these so-called glass tubes that are on the planet?
You know, I had a look at those, and I've discovered exactly what those are. And again, this is my opinion, but looking at the photos and working with a device called a Kunsttube, I've discovered a very easy explanation for these. There used to be an exhibit in many of the science centers or museums that had a long plastic tube that was clear, and they would put sand or styrofoam beads inside the tube, and they'd have a speaker at one end. And when you turn the speaker on, you run the frequency up and down, and it creates little bars all the way down the tube, little mounds of the sand or the styrofoam. And the spacing of these mounds depends on the wavelength. Now imagine you have a long, narrow gully on Mars, and the wind is whipping down that gully, and it's resonating. We've all heard the wind whistle when it passes through a certain portion of a building or past a certain canyon. Imagine miles-long undisturbed canyons on Mars with the wind whistling through them, and that resonating, whistling wind creating standing sand dunes at regular intervals. And when you look at the pictures with that in mind, you can see that, yes, indeed, these are sand dunes.
So you and Richard will chat a little bit next hour, Sir Charles. Different views, similar views. It's going to be fascinating just to see your take on some of his things and his on yours. But, you know, he's a believer in the face on Mars. I don't think you are. Are you?
No, actually, it appears to me that the cause of the face and the pyramid forms in that region is very simple. Again, we know that there are glaciers under the soil. If you end up with a crack in a glacier, it tends to create a long linear zone in it or a line-shaped crack as the water melts or evaporates away. And the soil deposited on top of that glacier will slide down the side like sand in an hourglass to the angle of repose, as it's called. Well, if you have blocks of ice under the soil eroding away, the soil is going to slide down on the sides and create slope sides all around it. And there's a very natural way of producing the shape of the face, the pyramids, and other forms that we see.
So you think the pyramids, those objects that look like pyramids, again, are natural formations?
I do believe they're natural formations caused by the existence of glaciers just under the soil.
What about the machine parts or gears?
You know, that's a very good one. And many of those were brought to my attention a while back when I was doing this research. Many of those odd items were very difficult to classify until I realized what I was looking at. Those strange geared or toothed wheels that we find are seashells. They have exact analogs on Earth that look very much like machine parts. If you see them from the wrong angle, you'd mistake it for a piece of a machine very easily. And, of course, that's another issue we address both on my website and in the book. We talk about all the different forms marine life has and how some of them can fool you into believing some very odd or strange things.
Okay, so this leads us up to intelligent life on Mars or not. Based on what you're saying, I don't think you will tell us that you believe that there had been intelligent life on that planet.
In my opinion, anything native to Mars is probably not much smarter than a shark or a squid. I don't think that any intelligent life evolved on the planet, at least at this point, and I have to qualify it, I have not seen any evidence that convinces me anything smarter than a small animal would have ever been existent on the planet.
But you're open to the possibilities.
Oh, I'm open to possibilities. I know that there is intelligent life in the universe. There must be when you consider that in our galaxy alone, there are over 400 billion stars. And so far, just about every star we've examined tends to show planets. So somewhere out in those hundreds of billions of worlds that we're going to find over the coming years, there has to be something alive and there has to be something intelligent.
Why hasn't NASA admitted to the possibility of the existence of this possible alien life?
Well, number one, you know, they have to be very careful and very circumspect about what they do announce, because it's bad for an organization to look foolish. So I can understand a little reluctance to say things about life forms on another planet. But number two, imagine for a moment that they admitted that there was something intelligent out there and it wasn't necessarily friendly, it was an unknown. Well, it could cause a panic in some people's minds, and they wouldn't want to know that there is something out there that is more capable and perhaps more intelligent than we are. And a lot of people base a lot of what they believe on religious ideas.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
So many of them will reject outright any thought that there could be something as intelligent as a person building machinery or doing anything like composing symphonies or making buildings. And, you know, people have to stop and think. If you have aliens living on a planet that are intelligent like human beings, they're going to have the same needs and problems we have. They'll have farming and schools. They'll have factories. They'll have the same sorts of things that we do. So in an example that many of us have encountered in the past, historically, when a technically advanced civilization comes in contact with a lesser advanced civilization, the lesser advanced civilization almost always gets wiped out or suffers badly. And people don't want to see that happen.
But, you know, the Vatican came out several months ago with a statement that the belief in extraterrestrial life does not hurt or negate the belief in a god or God, which
well,
I think was a pretty dramatic
Vatican
statement.
The Vatican seems a bit more progressive than NASA in that statement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who would have ever thought?
You know, to me, it sounds, and you know what? They've got their own observatories, and to me, that they are far ahead in the search for extraterrestrial life than NASA is. Or if NASA doesn't admit it, they may be doing something in some kind of black ops program somewhere. You never know.
Well, you know, it's an issue that we all will have to confront eventually, and a lot of people don't like to confront the issues. It's easier for them to go through their workaday existence. But, you know, we have found fossils, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people will be convinced when they see what's here. And it's just a matter of time, again. We're going to find living organisms, and eventually we're going to find intelligence.
Do you believe these fossils that are on Mars would also echo the same kind of creatures we've got on this planet?
Well, you know, many
people
object to that, and I believe that they do, and here's why. Many times people have said, well, alien life would be entirely different from what we have on Earth. It would follow a completely different evolutionary path. But here's the error in that argument. Organisms are shaped by the jobs they have to do to survive. They're shaped by their environment. And as we know, chemistry and physics being the same, in many cases, nature's going to arrive at the same solutions. On the Earth, the eye evolved perhaps 11 or more times independently in different contexts, in different organisms. And that's something that happened again and again because of random mutations. And on the Earth, many organisms evolved as marsupials and as non-marsupial forms, and they look the same. So we have the equivalents of bears and tigers and dogs in the marsupial world, and they're not related at all to the bears and tigers and dogs we have that are not marsupials. So we're going to expect parallel or convergent evolution, and other worlds aren't exempt from this.
And I think that when you reach the, I'm not going to say the evolutionary end, because I'm just not sure about that. I'm a believer in a creator. But I believe that when you get to the point of pure intelligence, that you're going to have creatures that are going to be similar to us.
And that's very possible. Notice that all of the life on Earth follows a very small number of templates. Even the giraffe has the same number of neck bones that a human being does. So there are certain things that occur throughout nature that echo each other because we have common origins. If we look at other animals on other planets, they'll probably have very similar forms. Now, it's not to say we're not going to discover something very unusual or very different. I mean, look at the platypus. There's a weird animal for you.
Sure. Well, you know what? we're still finding these very different and weird and unusual creatures. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, you know, down in the depths of the ocean, they found another couple hundred more little creatures that they never knew existed. So, yeah. So they're out there. I mean, this universe is full of strange things.
Well, if you want to see alien life, look in the oceans.
Right.
There's some very, very strange creatures down in our seas.
How would these microbial forms of life or this marine type of life, how would it exist on Mars today if it was able to survive?
Well, some of it may exist in caverns, and we have found caverns on Mars at this point. So some could be sheltered underground, and that wouldn't be too surprising. Some of it could be in alcoves, such as the apparent brine lakes that exist on Mars, and they found five or six of those. I've got a few pictures of those on my site. There are apparently lakes of brine on the surface, and many of them could live in there, and they could go through the same sort of a life cycle that the brine shrimp does. So we could have a number of organisms that are suspended in the ice, and of course, researchers have been able to revive bacteria that have stuck in salt crystals for over 200 million years. So the evidence is very good that under the proper conditions, fossilization isn't the only option for life. Sometimes it will dry out or desiccate and go into a state of natural hibernation.
What would these creatures eat on the planet if they were there now?
Well, in any world, you have to have some sort of food for anything to live. And that also takes us to a very interesting question. What would the first organism in the world eat?
That's right.
The organic soup itself, the tholin that's around, the primordial soup, is a food. So even on Mars, there are going to be materials in the soil that bacteria and fungus could eat, and then higher creatures will live off of them. You'll notice in nature there is a tendency for tiny, very numerous organisms to spread out and collect the energy and the minerals. And it's typically diatoms or algae or bacteria doing the primary digesting and collecting. And then other organisms that are larger will feed on them. They'll graze on them. And then there's a food chain, a pyramid that goes up, larger organisms with lesser numbers eating the smaller ones that have gathered everything for them. And so we'll see the same sort of a system on any world.
That is fascinating. They do have to eat, so there's something there for them. And the big question is, how big did these creatures get? Were they whale-like, do you think?
Well, while that's possible, Mars probably didn't have a great deal of oxygen in its environment. We were going to have to look at how that limits the size of energetic organisms. I don't have any evidence of anything larger than 3 or 4 inches in length, call it 10 centimeters,
okay,
in any of the things that I've looked at. But again, we've only looked at a very small area and a very restricted one at that.
A vast oxygenated planet, like Earth was during the dinosaur era, creates larger creatures, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly tends to. It all happens to hinge on how well an organism can survive by being small and fleet and nimble, or very large and carnivorous or herbivorous. So you end up with things like the Tyrannosaurus, which is basically the meat eater, or you end up with things like a Brontosaurus, which is basically a herbivore. He grazes on the plants. But yes, you know, the size of an organism is going to be related to how effectively it can get around, how much oxygen it takes from its environment, and those sorts of factors. Now, one interesting piece of information that I've come across, and it seems nobody recognizes this, is this. Mars is the red planet because of rust, because of iron oxide. Well, what oxidized all that iron? There had to have been free oxygen, not just water, in its past, in order to make the planet rust red. And it happened on our planet billions of years ago. That's what formed the red iron deposits that we mine today.
That's a good point, Sir Charles. Good point indeed. Stay with us. Sir Charles Schultz with us for the entire program. Richard C. Hoagland joins us to share his views. We'll share their perspective together. And I'll sit back and we'll learn. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM.